Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to the New Books Network, New Books in History. I'm your host, R. Grant Kleiser. With me today is Professor Tim Lockley. Dr. Lockley is a professor at the University of Warwick, where he teaches mainly American history. He has published multiple books, articles, and book chapters on the colonial and antebellum South, Maroon and slave communities, the social and racial history of Savannah, Georgia, and other related topics. His new book, Military Medicine and the Making of Race, Life and Death in the West India Regiments, 1795 to 1874, charts the origins and evolution of the British Army's so-called West India Regiments. These were soldiers of African descent who fought in the British military in the Caribbean and West Africa. Dr. Lockley discusses how white medical and statistical observations of these regiments changed over time, which helped develop perceptions of race and racism in the 19th century Anglo-American world. Dr. Lockley, many thanks for being with us today, and congratulations on this new publication.
Thank you.
All right. So first off, since many of our listeners might not be familiar with this topic, can you just describe what the West India Regiments were and how they came about?
Sure. So the West India Regiments were regular units of the British Army that were created in 1795 through 1798. There ends up being about 12 of these regiments, and they're created in the West India Islands. And they are created mainly, as I argue in this book, in response to the inability of European soldiers to live long enough to be useful. Now, the Caribbean has always been a dangerous place for European soldiers to be stationed. There's always been a relatively high mortality rate, but it's been sort of been manageable for quite a long period of time. And then in the 1790s, there's a new strain of yellow fever that comes. It's brought in from Africa, and it absolutely devastates European regiments. I mean, regiments are losing 20-30% of their men. And the British military operation in the Caribbean, they're engaged at the time in a war with France, just becomes unviable. They can't staff their regiments substantially. And so they start to think seriously about recruiting black soldiers, soldiers of African descent. And they've done this before. There have been African soldiers working in the British Army throughout the 18th century in the Caribbean. But they've always been fairly short term. They've been recruited for a campaign and then they've been disbanded. But this is the first attempt to do it seriously. We're going to have a bunch of men who are going to be permanently on the army regiment roll. And they start in 1795. They try to recruit among the islands. They try to recruit local people. They recruit some men in captured French islands to serve in the British Army. But very quickly, they realize they can't recruit enough men. And so about 1797, 1798, they start to buy men from slave ships coming directly from Africa. And so people would come off slave ships from Africa. They would be assessed as to their age, health, etc. And they're obviously all men. And then they would be given a uniform and they would be instructed in the arts of being a regimental soldier. And over the course of the next 5 years or so, so by about sort of 1801, 1802, there are around 6,000 men under arms in the West India regiments.
That's such a fascinating history, especially, you know, thinking of the West Indies as this place of disease. And, you know, I'm thinking of J.R. McNeil's book, Mosquito Empires, and, you know, his emphasis on how, you know, it's such a death trap in the West Indies, especially with yellow fever, as you said, and, you know, his anecdotes of, you know, British, especially British regiments being sent there for punishment, right? Because it's such a death trap, and you know, or perhaps Irish soldiers who are more dispensable, perhaps in the London mentality, sent there. And it's just interesting too to think that, you know, the situation must have gotten so desperate in the 1790s that perhaps any, you know, qualms of arming people of African descent, some people, you know, said who are directly bought off of slave ships, in part to help quell any potential slave revolts, that consideration perhaps is over, is not as important as the very fact of being able to have enough troops to be useful there. So, you know, is that kind of an accurate description of the situation in the 1790s?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there'd always been a wastage of European regiments, and it perhaps averaged between 5% and 10% a year. But the army seems to have thought that was acceptable. I mean, it's a pretty high mortality rate, to be honest, but it seems to have thought, you know, we can live with that. But it's when it gets to, you know, 30%, and not only that, you know, of the remaining 70%, maybe half are sick. And so your actual fighting strength is down to, you know, 30-40% of the men meant to be, you know, in the regiment. You've only got 30% left who could actually, you know, hold a weapon if they had to. That's when they start to realize that actually they can't do anything. They can't mount any campaigns. They can't even hold on to what they've got. And they're facing, you know, a renewed and reinvigorated France in the mid-1790s, because the French by then have ended slavery in their colonies. The French, the new French Republic has ended slavery in Saint-Domingue and in Guadeloupe and Martinique. And they are recruiting these formerly enslaved people into the French army to fight the British. And so definitely the idea becomes, is one that the British borrow from the French. And the French show them, you know, how to do it effectively. And they realize they haven't got a hope of competing in France, with France, in the Caribbean without doing this.
The classic history of emulating empires and in this time of international competition, that's really, really, really interesting. So, you know, your previous work, it seems, is mostly focused on the antebellum South, particularly South Carolina and Georgia. So I just was wondering what prompted you to conduct research on this topic that seems a little bit farther afield from your other publications.
Yeah, well, I think it was a progression from being interested in slavery in the US, mm-hmm. and I'd written an article and done some research on black mortality and the factors that influence mortality, especially in coastal Georgia and these kind of factors. And I mean, I was interested in things like the impact of disease, especially epidemics, on the enslaved population. And so that was sort of my in to the topic, the idea of racialized medicine, I guess. And then a colleague of mine at Warwick, David Lambert, he and I were chatting, and he was telling me about the West India regiments. Now, he's a Caribbean historian, much more so than I am, in training. And he was telling me about the West India regiments, and we got chatting as to how we could, you know, work on these the regiments together, but, you know, doing different, you know, aspects of their lives. And he's interested, very much interested in their membership and their being part of the British Empire, and how they're perceived and people react to them in Britain. And I was interested in the medical angle. So we thought together we could actually run a project, very, very nice project, working on them, sort of approaching them from different aspects. And so we applied for a research grant, which we got, and we had a 4-year project working on these soldiers from different angles. And it's great to work on a project with other people. So you can, you know, bounce ideas off people. You've got a set of people who know what you're talking about, and that's always great. And we worked with the British Library in London. So we've created a website, an educational website, which is designed for school children, and it has lesson plans, etc. And it's designed to tell a story of the Atlantic world, the Black Atlantic world, that doesn't necessarily revolve around slavery. So certainly in the British context, the curriculum about Black life in the 18th century is all about slavery or anti-slavery. Well, here was a story about, you know, Black men in the Atlantic world doing something quite different, fighting for empire, fighting as agents of the British Crown. And we thought that'd be a different type of story to tell. And so we've created these lessons for school children, which are all on the British Library website. And anyone out there who is listening and who is interested in offering an educational experience to school children, they can use this resource completely free of charge. It's got all the resources, got the lesson plans, all down there on the British Library's website.
Wow, that's really great. I, you know, a couple points there. You know, so great to see a success story for collaboration, especially in a discipline, I think, of history that sometimes eschews collaboration. So that's really nice to hear, and especially too those resources, especially for pedagogy. That's really fantastic. So kind of, you know, jumping off a couple points you made there, especially this idea of racialized medicine. And, you know, this book is primarily, I think, about race. And first, you know, I have a couple follow-up questions here, but if you could kind of just enumerate what you mean when you say race, how do you define race in this book?
Well, I think as I start out by saying, like on page one, you know, race is a really slippery concept. It's a tricky concept to work with. I think what I'm aiming for is how people understood race and how people attributed things to Black soldiers, which only applied to them because they were either black-skinned or from Africa. And so the very creation of the regiments is all about the special, supposedly special properties that Africans have in combating tropical diseases, that they have special abilities that Europeans don't have. And so a lot of the book is about how Europeans, especially English people, but not just English people, define race in a sort of medicalized way, an increasingly medicalized way. And they decide that those of African descent have special, you know, medical properties. And that's not just the fact that they are resistant to tropical diseases. It's the fact that they think they can work harder and longer in tropical conditions. They've got better stamina than Europeans. Now, of course, that's been the justification for slavery for the previous 150 years. But they particularly note it with regard to these West India Regiment soldiers as well. But they also believe that they are better at certain aspects of soldiering, naturally better, innately better. And that includes things like they have better eyesight, so they're better marksmen. That they have better hearing, they're better at bushcraft, at tracking, those kinds of things that are all sort of embodied in the Black soldier, that make them this ideal Black soldier for serving in tropical environments. But they're also very conscious of the fact that this tropical body is not suited for service outside of the tropics. So attempts to use them in other regions, for example, in Gibraltar or in North America, don't come off very well. And they attribute that not to bad planning or lack of resources or those kind of things. They attribute it to a racialized weakness, that these men don't survive and thrive in colder conditions because that's not where they're suited to be. They're suited to be in the tropics. So yeah, it's all about how you know, race and medicine intertwine here in really sort of interesting ways, and West India regiments end up being sort of at the heart of that story, and that's sort of why I wrote the book.
Mm-hmm. And you know, going back to another kind of follow up here, in your last comment you said, talking about how the narrative in Caribbean studies in particular is all about slavery. And certainly in most discussions, I would say, and obviously I'm an early modernist, so perhaps not as much in the 19th century, but most discussions about racism, it comes back to this sort of origins debate or this chicken and egg debate, you know, which came first, slavery or racism. But obviously, as you just kind of mentioned, your monograph talks very little about slavery. So why then, in your mind, is slavery not sufficient to study race and racism here?
I think because the status of these men is interesting. They start out being bought from slave ships. But in 1807, Britain bans the Atlantic slave trade. So that ends up the source for slaves, for recruits into the regiments. And so they turn to people captured off other people's slave ships, the so-called liberated Africans, and they get recruited in Sierra Leone. So that's the alternative source of recruits. And only by sort of the middle of the 19th century, the 1840s, 1850s, do people locally born in the West Indies start to become the main source of recruits into the West India regiments. So for the first 50 or years or so, they're mainly African-born people. And they're not treated like slaves. And by that, I mean, and even when they officially are slaves, like that first 10 years or so, they, you know, legally you might say they were slaves, they're not treated as slaves because the army never sells them. So it never tries to trade in men who are no longer useful as soldiers. It never tries to sort of sell them on after they've done 10 years of soldiering. In fact, what they do is they treat them exactly like any other soldier of the British Army. Now, they don't treat anyone in the British Army particularly well, it has to be said. So working in the British Army as a rank and file soldier is quite a hard job. The discipline levels are brutal. There's lots of, you know, harsh punishments for minor crimes. But these apply to white European soldiers as well as African soldiers. But when these men are injured, they don't get rid of them. They treat them in the regimental hospitals. When those men are injured and not able to return to active service, they are given things like guard duty. And when they become old and no longer useful as regimental soldiers, they are retired. And they're not retired as in sold off. They are retired to places like Trinidad and Belize, Britain's colony in Honduras, and they are given little bits of land, and they are allowed to, you know, become, you know, subsistence farmers. Some even end up in Sierra Leone. So the army never treats them like slaves, and they are treated as free black men, I guess, despite what their legal status might be. And I think that's the interesting thing about the West India regiments, in that they are easily the largest body of free black men in the Atlantic world that we can study as a group, because the one thing the army does really well is gather records. And so they are the most heavily documented body of men over the course of, you know, more than a century, that we can study to understand how these people, you know, lived and died. And that's what, you know, that's why I wrote the book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's I think just a great intervention. And so just moving back to the content of the book and the comments you made earlier, you know, talking about the West India regiments and how especially surgeons were examining these black soldiers and established that these people were, you know, inherently different. You use the word superhuman. They had special medical properties, more resistant to diseases, but as you said, could take on harder physical challenges, had increased hearing, better eyesight. And I was just wondering, you know, how and why did these surgeons come to that conclusion? Was this purely based on just empirical, you know, as you said, the British Army is really good at collecting data and they just kind of observed this trend, or is there something else going on there?
There's a combination of things going on. They come primed to think they are superhuman, because there have been plenty of medical treatises written before the West Indian regiments were even founded, which say that black people have special resistive properties to disease, tropical diseases. So those things are not new, and those would have been read by army surgeons. But every regiment has a surgeon attached to it. And sometimes they have a surgeon and an assistant surgeon, so there might be two medical officers. And every garrison place has a hospital room or wing where the men who are sick are treated. And we know from the records that do survive, they're not by no means comprehensive in terms of detailing every single case, but those sort of snapshots of records that survive, we know that most regiments had men visiting the hospital on average twice a year. And that tells us that the surgeons probably knew these men better than any other white officer. Because the white officer class, the lieutenants, the captains, the majors, they would have a certain number of men to look after. Maybe, 100, whatever. But they wouldn't see the entire regiment. They wouldn't be involved with the entire regiment on a regular basis. The surgeons, by contrast, probably would see the entire regiment over a period of time. And then a lot of it is empirical. A lot of it is their observations into what people's behaviour was like. So these surgeons, they see all the men regularly, and they write down the details of each case that they deal with. And they report these cases on an annual basis back to the War Office in London. And some of these records survive. So we've got lists of cases treated. Sometimes we have quite detailed notes as to how the men were treated. Sometimes they list treatment regimens and outcomes, which is really useful for the medical historian. We know exactly what medicines these people were given and how long they were in hospital and how long before they got better. Those kind of things, the mortality rates from certain diseases, that's all documented. So they're not comprehensive for every regiment over the whole period. They are, snapshots we get. But overall, they're really useful. So what we have is increasingly these surgeons start to try to treat these black soldiers slightly differently to how they treat white soldiers. So sometimes they write that they need different medicines to white people. And they base that on the fact that treatments for white people might involve bloodletting, for instance. That's a very common treatment for pretty much any illness in the 19th century. But they quickly decide that bloodletting isn't a good treatment for black people. And other treatment regimens are required. So they start to make these sort of medicalized generalities of differences between white people and their black soldiers. And sometimes they're doing this because they're treating white and black soldiers in the same hospitals. When they've got garrison hospitals in Barbados and places like that where both white and black soldiers are, the same surgeons are treating both white soldiers and black soldiers. And they're commenting the fact that, for instance, the black soldiers recover from wounds faster than the white soldiers. And they wonder why that is. And this sort of strengthens this sort of superhuman argument, which is the dominant narrative in the medical literature for the first sort of 40 years or so of the West India regiments, right up until the mid-1830s. This dominant narrative of you've got these super strong men who have this special skin, and they attribute black skin to having very special qualities, in that it's heals faster, it's tougher, it's harder to damage, and sometimes they write about that that if they try to take blood from a black soldier, they find it really difficult to penetrate the skin with the needle. That sometimes they say it blunts the needle, and that's a really interesting idea. But it's something that you then see repeated again and again and again in other literature. So it's something that emerges out of the treatment of black soldiers in these military hospitals.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And just interesting to note too, you know, that how dominant that is for, as you said, 30 or 40 years in the first part of the 19th century. And just because there's a moment too that I wanted to bring up that, and this is somewhat selfish because I study the island of Dominica in the 19th century, but you talk about how the West India regiment has a mutiny in 1802. And I'm just wondering, you know, it seems like this medical literature is so dominant in their perceptions, but are events on the ground, on performances on the ground, causing any doubts at all in this perception of these troops as superhuman?
I think generally I would say no, because anyone who comments on their military prowess, for instance, in that first 30 years, is full of praise, saying they're brave and, you know, great soldiers. They venture into places where white troops don't want to go. They're quite happy to hunt out, you know, runaway slaves, rebel slaves, you know, in islands like St. Lucia or St. Vincent, and quite happy to fight against the French, armed French black people in Saint-Domingue. And the Dominica episode in 1802 is fascinating. I mean, it's a great story, the mutiny of the 8th West India Regiment. But it all comes about because the governor of Dominica absolutely subscribes to this idea that his soldiers, his 8th West India Regiment, can, you know, work in tropical conditions, much more so than white people can. And he sends them out to work in a swamp to basically do work that slaves do, because he wants to drain this swamp. And there's lots of, I mean, Governor Johnston of Dominica, I mean, somebody should write a biography of him because, you know, he comes across as such an unprincipled rogue. And how he gets away with it is beyond me. I mean, there's elite corruption on an epic scale. So,
ironically, you want to drain a swamp then, right?
Well, that gives a whole new meaning to literally draining the swamp. And, you know, and he's entirely responsible for this mutiny. The fact that he pushes, you know, these things to happen, and these men say, no, we're not doing this. This is slave work, and it pushes over into a mutiny where some of the white officers are killed, and it doesn't turn out well for the mutineers. I mean, they're slaughtered. But it's interesting that the commander in the West Indies, Thomas Trigg, who's commander of the entire, you know, armed forces, not just this regiment, doesn't blame the soldiers, even though they have to be punished. I mean, discipline requires them to be punished, and he doesn't, you know, doubt that those who were executed deserve to be executed. He says, you know, the real blame needs to be pointed at the white officers and Johnston himself, who caused it, and that their attitudes towards using and abusing black soldiers was responsible.
Yeah, that's just such a fascinating moment there, and this development of those ideas, and you know, it only is more fascinating in my mind by the fact that, you know, the narrative really turns pretty 180 in the 1830s, when you talk about how statisticians instead highlight the vulnerabilities of West India Regiment soldiers.
Yeah.
Not them as superhuman, but perhaps more towards being subhuman or their type of human. How did this, you know, pretty radical transition in perception come about, you know, so quickly?
It comes about because the army had been collecting really good medical data since 1817. And by the mid-1830s, they decide to really do something with this data, to do an analysis of it. And they commission this guy, Alexander Tulloch, to work on it. And he's an army officer. He'd been in India, I think. And he works on this data. And it's just about how you interpret data. I think that's essentially what it is. So for the first time, they've got really good data, but then it's how you interpret it. So the data shows, just as we'd always known, that white mortality, white soldierly mortality in the West Indies is higher than black soldierly mortality. You know, so far, so good. That's exactly what we'd known for the previous, you know, 50 years. You know, but Tulloch's spin on this is not that. That is not that this is great and we should use black soldiers. His spin instead is that the mortality amongst the West India regiments is higher than a native population should be. So he compares the West India regiments not with European soldiers, but instead with indigenous troops fighting in either Africa or India or, you know, other places around the world. And he says, when you look at it like that, then the mortality of the West India regiments is probably double what it should be. And then he goes on to a very complicated, you know, argument where he says, you know, this means that Africans should not be used militarily outside of Africa, and they shouldn't be used in the West Indies. So he turns this whole thing on its head because he's trying to make an argument that basically you should only use troops in climates where they were native. So you should use African troops in Africa, Indian troops in India, British troops in Europe, I guess. But he attributes that difference to climate. And he says that there's something in the West India climate that doesn't agree with the African. And everyone is effectively by nature suited to a specific place where they are uniquely adapted. Mm.
Yeah, and you know, this is it's just so fascinating how, you know, interpretations, statistical interpretations can sort of turn something on its head, especially, as you know, in this era where statistics is taking on a sort of emergence as such an important science at this time.
Sure.
And has such wide appeal and such, you know, it's trusted by so many people in this era.
Yeah, it's given this sort of really slightly mythological status. It's like this is proper data science, and therefore it's true and it's a hard fact and you can't question it. I mean, nowadays we would look at any statistic and say, okay, so how are you interpreting and spinning the statistics? We all know about how these things are spun in terms of, you know, how politicians use statistics to prove whatever case they want to make. But in the 19th century, people think that statistics are just statistics, and therefore they can't be spun. They are hard facts. And Tulloch presents his spinning of them as hard facts. And his importance comes out of the fact that his conclusions are really widely reported and discussed. Not only in Britain, but also in the US. And they are reported not only in military journals, but in medical journals. And so they become an absolute trope of this 1840s, 1850s literature about the differences between white and black people. And that black people are innately suited to living in tropical zones. And that, you know, that's everyone's suited to where they were, you know, their ancestors were born, and nobody should move.
Why do you think it has such a wide appeal?
I think it just hits the right, it just comes out at the right time. So we're just emerging into ethnology being a really popular scientific discourse. So people are really interested in the origins of man. Where does man come from? Are there more than one type of man? Is everybody the same, or are they all different? And so people have been like talking about this for 100 years, but they're really getting into it in the 1840s and 50s. And people are pushing quite strongly now against the religious narrative, the biblical narrative of we all come from, you know, one stock. And they're saying, actually, you know, the Bible, you know, you can revere the Bible as much as you like, but it's not very scientific. And, you know, the Bible, remember, says that the world was created, what was it, something like 4000 BC or something like that. Somebody done a calculation at some point. And science in this period is saying, you know, no, that doesn't add up. Look at geology, look at fossils, look at those things that are emerging in the 19th century that are just saying the world is way, way, way older than the Bible suggests. And then if you can basically throw out the Bible as scientific truth, then it opens up a whole new vista to question the place of man and the origins of man. And it allows a window for people to say that we all don't come from one origin, that actually there are multiple origins, parallel evolutions of effectively, that Europeans and Africans are not that related. They're certainly not the same, but they're definitely not related. And they are fundamentally and innately and irreversibly, you know, different. And this suits a whole load of, you know, racialized narratives in the Victorian era, in their sort of mid 19th century, which ties in with the, you know, white supremacy in the US, but also the ideas of empire and colonialism in Britain and in France, where they're busy, you know, starting to push into Africa and Asia and Australasia, places like that, which is a narrative of white supremacy. And if you can suddenly have statistical evidence that says, you know, white people are better and black people are actually inferior, and they're physically inferior, then it's a whole new story. And that's where the West India regiments are used to, in order to sort of make this case. And they're used because there's no comparable set of data about black people anywhere in the world. So the fact that the British have collected this data on their black soldiers for a period of time and then discussed it and then analysed it and then published it, they just make them the only place that people can go to for evidence.
Yeah. It's also really fascinating to me how this is happening in the 1830s, given the fact that, in the British world at least, this is the era of abolition, of emancipation. That, you know, slowly in the 1830s, the British are gradually emancipating slaves and their empire, as you noted, you know, 30 years before it abolished the slave trade. But, you know, this is an era where slavery, at least in its legal forms, is dissipating, is on the decline. Do you think that there's some sort of paradox here between these ideas of more scientific or biological racism and the end of slavery, or does that make sense?
I think it's always been a fallacy to think that Britain's abolition of slavery was a mark of Britain's massive humanitarianism, and that Britain was a post-racial society. It was never anything like that. You know, Britain had its reasons for abolishing slavery. It was, in some respects, a convenient humanitarian mantle to wear, to say, oh, look, aren't we, you know, humanitarian because we've abolished slavery, even though they tried to replace slavery with apprenticeship in the Caribbean, and then they quickly adopted indentureship from India, and you know, a whole load of Indian people were shipped out to Africa and the Caribbean, sort of replace lost labour. Is that there were also economic reasons, you know, why slavery was abolished, and effectively, I think getting rid of slavery, which they maybe looked and thought made them look bad. Once they've done that, then they sort of forget about it, and they can basically say, "Well, we're not bad because we don't have slavery." You know, look at America; America has slavery, but actually, it gives them like a blank slate to embark on colonialism in all its worst forms, including, you know, genocide against native peoples all over the place. And the British are extremely efficient and brutal at doing that all over the world. And so we shouldn't equate abolition of slavery with any kind of long-lasting humanitarianism. In fact, humanitarianism disappears pretty quickly. And they can get back to believing in white superiority, and of white superiority specifically, you know, British superiority. You know, they certainly don't think the French are their equals, but they think the French are probably, you know, they would accept that the French are above, you know, Africans and Indians and any other type of non-white person in racial hierarchies. And so the racial discourse of the 19th century is, you know, unchallenged white supremacy, because that's what history tells them. They know that every time they go off into these places, that they are going to be able to trample over indigenous peoples with impunity because they have the technology and military power to do so. So they know that, you know, by the 19th century, the British Army can easily defeat native peoples if it wants to. And it might just require the Navy to sit offshore and shell somewhere in order to gain a surrender. But it's able to do that.
Yeah. So we talked about how the West India regiments are so fundamental to this concept of these new concepts of race and scientific racism and differences between different humans. And I'm just wondering, you know, it's interesting how long lasting these West India regiments are going into the 20th century. And can you just kind of describe a little bit how their role changes as a result of these new perceptions?
Sure. So the you know, fairly early on in the 19th century, they are used in Africa, and they are used in Gambia, in modern-day Ghana, or the Gold Coast, as it was known, and then in modern-day Nigeria. And they're used mainly as garrison troops. So there have been attempts to have white garrison troops in West Africa. They're nearly all been complete failures. The white soldiers had succumbed to either malaria or yellow fever pretty quickly, to the extent that there was like literally nobody left. And so using the West India regiments, known to have this kind of element of tropical resistance to tropical diseases, is a fairly sensible thing for the army to do. It's perfectly logical. They use the army, the West India regiments, in expeditions against the local African peoples periodically, though they prefer to have sort of agreements with these people if they can, but they're not afraid to use them. I mean, and there's plenty of examples of them being used in military conflict. They're not really used in the Caribbean after 1815 because they're not no longer in conflict with France. And so again, they're garrison troops, and they're split up in small units on each island, and you know, some on the mainland, some in Guyana, obviously, and in Belize, but mainly in Barbados or Trinidad or Jamaica or wherever. They are used to suppress slave revolts. So we know that they are absolutely crucial in the suppression of the 1816 revolt in Barbados, in the 1823 revolt in Guyana. They're also involved in the suppression of the Moreton Bay Rebellion in 1865 in Jamaica. So they are there basically as a British military presence in the Caribbean throughout this period. But gradually, the soldiers become less African and become more West Indian. So there are more and more recruits from the West Indies. And so their ethnicity, I guess, changes over time. But their employment in West Africa continues right the way through the 19th century and even into the 20th century. So by the time of the First World War, we see the West India regiments being used on campaign against German colonies in West Africa and in East Africa. So they're used against Togo and Tanganyika in East Africa. And they carry on right the way through till 1927 when they're finally disbanded. They're not used in Europe, so they're not used in the Western Front in the First World War. They're only used in Africa, but they are you know, a presence on the ground, and Britain is very happy to have them there and to use them. But they're mainly used, as I say, for 100 years, sort of as garrison soldiers.
Yeah, well, I guess my final question here, you know, since we've gone over this content so much, but also I want to leave our listeners with some incentive to buy the book to hear all of the anecdotes and explanations for the rise and fall here of the West India regiments. But I'd like to talk to you about some of the benefits and challenges of studying this topic from a source perspective. As you mentioned, there's so much written on these West India regiments. It must have been, you know, a very compared to other Black communities, perhaps a much more fruitful source base. But did you also experience challenges coming at this topic methodologically?
Yeah, there are big gaps in the records. A lot of the data that's collected is statistical, and there's only so much you can do with statistics. So a lot of the data is to do with regimental returns, which is just numbers. It's like how many soldiers are in the regiment this month, how many are fit, how many are sick, how many have died, that kind of data. Well, you can only do so much with it. You know, you can chart it over time, but you can't do a lot of it. So you're looking for qualitative data a lot of the time. Some of that survival is patchy. There was certainly a huge amount more collected and written about the West India regiments than seems to survive now, or at least that I found. There would have been a lot more medical records, and we only have some of these that are left that we can work with. You know, what happened to them? Well, I don't know. There's no obvious explanation for why some survive and why some don't survive, but I suppose that's true of all types of records. Sometimes people just file them wrongly. Sometimes people throw them away. Who knows? It's very, very difficult to get the voice of the African recruit or the voice of the West Indian recruit into the West India regiments. They don't write memoirs. They don't write letters and diaries about their experiences as a soldier. So in contrast to white soldiers of the 19th century, of which there are many, many first-hand accounts written by them. What was it like being on campaign against Napoleon, for instance, or even in the Crimea or something like that? There's nothing in comparison by the West India Regiment soldiers. So finding out their voice, I think, is one of the hardest things. So we're always reading, you know, sources that are generated by white people, sometimes by officers, sometimes by observers, we don't know. But finding out what their perspective was on life is actually really pretty hard. You know, there's certainly more that you could do. There's some interesting episodes that could be explored in a bit more detail. You know, I go up in this book to 1874, but I don't really do anything after 1874. So there's another sort of 50 years of their histories that could be explored by another scholar. And, you know, you could think about how they were received in the Caribbean. You know, their position within Caribbean life and society is really interesting because their legacy, even though obviously the regiments have been disbanded for, you know, nearly 100 years now, their legacy is the uniform, the Zouave uniform, which they adopt in the 1850s, the very characteristic sort of baggy pantaloons. That's now the sort of ceremonial uniform of various militias in the Caribbean. So the Jamaican Defence Force or the Barbados Defence Force, that's their ceremonial uniform. The legacy of the bands, well, the bands were always part of life in the West India regiments, and yet those bands also sort of survive to this day. So, you know, there's certainly more that you could write about and their lasting cultural legacy, I guess, in the Caribbean.
Whether
other people are going to do that or not, I don't know. I don't think it's going to be me.
Well, I just want to say that, you know, this is a great part of this book is it answers the questions it seeks to answer so well. But as you mentioned, you know, this is just kind of opening up to this topic. And there are other moments and experiences and perspectives that other scholars can take up and hopefully be inspired by your book.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's loads of great records in the National Archives in Britain that you could use, military records. One thing, if you're going to work on the West India regiments, one place you have to look is that they're often filed in India records and not in West Indies records because of the name West India regiments. Something that I came across a couple of times, that everything's misfiled.
Wow, that is a good tip right there. Well, the last question that we ask everyone is just, you know, Dr. Lockley, do you have any other works or projects that are on the horizon for you? Anything that you want to pitch right now?
I've been working on an essay, I guess, on the involvement of the West India Regiments in the War of 1812. So that's something I'm working on right now. And that's because they've been sort of erased from that war. There's been some thing in the news very recently here in Britain about the erasure of non-white soldiers who fought in the First World War. And I wrote a blog post saying that's been going on for a lot longer than that. And so there are black soldiers fighting on the British side, for example, at the Battle of New Orleans in 1815. And very, very few people know they were ever there. And yet they probably made up, you know, a fifth of the British force at New Orleans. And, you know, if you look at any paintings of the battle, there's no black faces there. They're all white faces. So that's a really interesting little story. You know, the fact that black soldiers marched on Washington and were involved in the burning of Washington in 1814, you know, no one ever talks about that. So
yeah. Definitely. Well, no, that's great. I mean, especially because I think there's been a flourishing of those studies for the American Revolution, perhaps, but certainly not for the War of 1812 or other conflicts. So really looking forward to seeing that in print. And many thanks for your time today and for this really, really great discussion. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Military Medicine and the Making of Race is out now via Cambridge University Press. This is R. Grant Kleiser saying thanks so much for listening, and see you next time.